As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Total Soccer Show. This is the Weekend Review. My name is Ryan Bailey, and today we're looking back at a memorable weekend of soccer full of drama. Joining me to do so is the podcast equivalent of a goalkeeper scoring a 95th minute winning header. It's Taylor Rockwell.
Hello, I'll take that. I'll take the excitement, the electrifying enthusiasm, and the beardedness all at once.
Oh, you have all of those columns ticked, Tay-Tay. I've just realized that. Can you give
just
an emotional...
the physical fitness.
When we're done, can you give an emotional interview about how this podcast went as well? I'd really like to see that.
I can. Can I do it in this sort of out-of-breath emotional way where, like, you're waiting for them to finish it and they kind of ramble on and then have to catch their breath? That is kind of my style anyway. So, yeah, I think I could do that.
Excellent. Consider it done. Podcast extra coming up. Joining Taylor and I is a man whose analysis is more on target than a Yuri Tielemans rocket shot. It's Graham Ruthven.
Hello, Ryan. How are you? And much like Yuri Tielemans' rocket shot, my analysis comes from a blundering mistake made by the opposition and poor pressing by an Italian central midfielder. So, how are you?
You've got to take your victories where you can get them, Graham. Take them where you can get them is what I say. I'm very well, Graham. Thank you so much for asking. I have had a mixed weekend, though. I ripped my favourite jeans on Saturday, which was unfortunate. I kind of injured my Achilles while I was running on Saturday morning, which was a shame. But hey, Chelsea lost two cup finals this weekend, so not all's bad. That's what I say.
Were you running in the jeans? Is that how you ripped them?
Was I not supposed to run in the jeans? Maybe that was it.
There's nothing more suspicious than someone in the gym in jeans. I don't know if you ever come across people who wear jeans to the gym, but I'm always like, what is your ulterior motive here?
What activity are they doing in jeans, Graham?
Just on the treadmill, on the rowing machine. Do you ever come across people like that who are wearing jeans in the gym? That's quite a common occurrence at my gym.
Really?
Yeah.
Scotland, get it together. Also, no, I think there's an Always Sunny episode where Dee wears jeans to the gym, and it's a whole, like, I'm not seeing a lot of jeans. Yeah, I've never seen jeans at a gym. So, Graham, I think that you're just maybe in a very strange area where
it's
people make strange decisions. That'll do it. That'll do it as well. If only they made some sort of warm-up material that you could wear when it was cold outside.
Yeah.
In my gym, the gym I used to go to before COVID, there was an older gentleman who always used to come and, like, walk on a treadmill, and he wore jeans and, like, formal shoes, I think, as well. But I gave him a pass because he wasn't exactly, like, you know, he wasn't on the curling him out on the bench or anything. So that's the only example of that I can think of. But speaking of outfits, I think we have to assume that Chelsea's kit is doomed, this new kit. this new kit that they showed off. They played it in a Champions League final and an FA Cup final this weekend. They've got to scrap it. They've got to scrap it, haven't they? Can't play on with this.
It's reminiscent of the start of the season where, I don't know if you remember, but Chelsea had a new sponsor for this season, which is Three, the mobile network, and they conceded 3 goals in the first 3 games of this season, which seems like a bit of a jinx. So, yeah, the only thing that can stop them is a new kit launch.
I also take offence from the new Chelsea kit because it has yellow on it, and supporting a team from about 2 miles down the road who play in blue and yellow, I take offence to them trying to jump on our patch with the colours there. Taylor, any thoughts on kits?
I mean, I think we've just learned in recent history now that anytime you try to rebrand or change up your color scheme, it's not going to go well, and it's not the best idea unless you put actual thought into it. So maybe that's the issue. Chelsea just need to spend a little more time getting an even finer shade of blue, and then they'll be fine.
Finer shade of blue. That sounds like a hit waiting to happen there.
It really does. Parade there, Taylor. I'll take that.
One more thing before we get started. I wanted to mention that I played soccer for the first time in 15 months this past week.
And how'd that go?
It went pretty well.
Jeans.
The jeans suffered for it. The jeans suffered for it, and I got an injured Achilles. But goal and an assist, it was okay. It was okay for me personally. But I felt it took me about 3 days to recover from it. Because I think not using those muscles for so long, mm-hmm. and I felt very rusty while I was out there as well. It was wonderful to get back out of there for the first time in so long. But yeah, I think I need a few games to get back into the rhythm of things, definitely.
And what's the method for getting ready for a game, Ryan? How do you warm up? Is it running? Is it jogging? Is it stretching? Is it curver? Are you doing moves? Are you just shooting with no stretching?
Oh, it's typical sort of Sunday league stuff. You turn up and just have some shots.
Ah, there you go. Of course.
I know that warm up too well.
And then you wonder why you pull your groin and your hamstring simultaneously in the first 45 seconds. Like, how did that possibly happen?
Very organized stuff. But yeah, and, I need to be better at warming down as well. I think that's a big Ooh. Part of it. Now that I'm of advanced years for a soccer player, I'm right up there now. So,
if Zlatan can do it, you can do it, Ryan.
Indeed, indeed. We're both pretty good physical specimens. I bet Zlatan rips his jeans all the time for probably different reasons to I did, in that I eat too much food. Shall we talk about the FA Cup final, gents? How about we do that? Chelsea against Leicester at Wembley Stadium. This one finishing 1-0 to Leicester, with the aforementioned Youri Tielemans making the difference with a wonderful strike. This was the 140th FA Cup final, the world's oldest domestic soccer competition. It was 52 years since Leicester were last in this one, although they pretty sure they were in the League Cup in the 90s. I think they won it then, if memory serves me correct. There were 22,000 fans in attendance here. Graham, a huge, huge difference here. I felt just watching it from my sofa, having actual fans in the stadium, the roar from the goal being like actually timed with the goal going in. and you know, it just felt very authentic. It felt really good. And having the players also run over to the fans at the end, the Leicester players, and sort of knee sliding and celebrating towards the fans. And you had Leicester's owner getting involved as well. I didn't have a dog in this race, but I felt quite emotional watching this. I felt a little bit teary. Like, I don't know whether it's nostalgia for the FA Cup, nostalgia for fans coming back, the fact that an underdog, if of sorts, won this game. But it all sorts of came together in this alchemy of emotion for me. I was in a glass cage with Ron Burgundy.
Yeah, I was also in that glass cage. I mean, it makes such a difference to just watching a game. The intensity, the excitement. I missed opposition fans going way when someone shoots over the bar. They don't have that on the canned crowd noise on the broadcasts. I missed that. And yeah, absolutely. The Tielemans goal was. There was certainly an emotion to it. And I think for the next 6 months, I also felt it when. Atlanta scored in the last minute against Montreal at the weekend. And I think maybe for the next 6 months, I'm just going to feel that and appreciate how much better soccer is with fans in the stands.
I was about to reference that Atlanta game as well. That late winner and the roar and the bends. That was another one of those feelings. Definitely, that's a great point there. And Taylor, I don't know if you saw in the stands at Wembley, they had the former owner of Leicester, Vijay Srivastava. Mm-hmm. He had his quote: "Our dreams can come true if we have the courage to pursue them." And you just see that, and you see what Leicester did in this game, and that just made me totes emosh, totes emosh.
And then was it his son getting hugs from all the players at the end of the game?
That's right.
which I think really intensified it and made a story in which it's what the team that are third right now beating the team in fourth, somehow an underdog story. But it did feel that way, and that it felt that way, especially so when you see the owner out there and you see sort of what it meant to the players and to the fans as well. And I will just agree with what both of you have already said, which is that it's great to have them there for the celebrations after the goal, for the celebrations at full time, but also for just moments like in the second half when Leicester are up and they're trying to see the game out. And I think Vardy earns a corner and then like vaults to his feet and picks up the crowd and everybody responds. And it's those moments you need. It's those moments that make the crowd so important because you can rally there. And that is a decent amount of energy. I've played in games when we had like 15 fans and them all cheering had an impact. So 22,000 fans cheering, or at least half of those 22,000, I think definitely also has an impact. And as we get more and more, it'll get louder and even more fun. But for now, it was just nice to see that sort of interaction and the reminder that the players also need those fans, enjoy having those fans for what they bring and the atmosphere they create.
15 fans, Taylor. Nice flex, by the way.
I mean, I think it was mostly just our like other team drunkenly yelling things, mostly.
It is odd that I did pitch this as an underdog victory. It is of sorts, but we do have to remember these are two teams who are owned by billionaires who both made money in questionable regimes, etc., and so on, both of whom, you know, at the top echelon of the table, and who face each other in the Premier League in a very important game on Tuesday as well. Why don't we talk about Chelsea and what went wrong or what went right here? Was this game, Taylor, on Thomas Tuchel? Can we question what he did here? I mean, Azpilicueta and Alonso as the wing back sort of drew my attention a little bit. The front three, we had Werner Mount and Ziyech. Was he trying to sort of play Ziyech into form, even play Werner into form in this game and using an FA Cup final platform to do so? And, you know, some people questioning Alonso, the aforementioned Alonso starting over Chilwell. In some ways, I think Tuchel's got criticism for this game, but if you look at Chelsea, they lost this game, which was reasonably even, to an absolute banger from 25 yards out. Schmeichel made a couple of incredible saves, absolutely incredible saves, and they get a narrow VAR decision going against them. So it's pretty fine margins in this one, Taylor. But what can we say about what Tuchel did wrong or right?
I mean, we can say a little bit about that because I would rather say a lot more about what Brendan Rodgers got right, because I think that is a big difference there, because Tuchel did sort of what I expected, barring a few of those little switches, like you mentioned with Azpilicueta playing as the right wing back and Reece James as the right center back. I'm assuming, as the commentators were pointing out, that was to deal with the pace and the counterattacking ability of Leicester. What I think they weren't really prepared for was the intensity of Leicester's press and how consistent and successful it was. Because, and again, I took some issue with the way this game was covered, because the halftime analysis seemed to be all about Leicester were rushing and Chelsea were being too hesitant. And the game that I saw, at least, and I'm happy to be wrong if either of you saw it differently, was Chelsea trying to build but not being able to pass through the middle because Leicester kept crowding there and then pressing so high that it forced these sort of direct balls into Timo Werner, who's going to have somebody tracking him. So oftentimes he's not going to be able to hold the ball up or hold the ball up easily. And then even when he does, now that you've had people drop in to try to support for the build out to deal with the press, when you do get the ball into his feet, he has nobody around him for 20 yards. And it seemed like Chelsea just really struggled to develop anything to get a rhythm going because of the way Leicester set up to defend. And I think you're absolutely right, though, Ryan, that they still find a way to get chances, to get moments. They batter Leicester for a decent chunk of the second half. I think that goal is pretty unfair in terms of, yes, it's probably a toenail offside, but once again, that just feels like a very silly way to enforce VAR, but such is life. But I think you're absolutely right that overall it's very fine margins, but credit to Leicester for, I guess, having a finer margin? Is that how it goes? A wider margin? I'm not sure which one it is.
They just find it out a little bit.
There we go.
So to speak. Graham, let's talk about Leicester, and Taylor mentioned they're defending there, a back five. This isn't the first time that Thomas Tuchel has faced a back five by any means, but it seems like they certainly contained Chelsea's front line there. I mean, Fofana was all over Werner, it seemed, for most of it, and Ziyech was made a little bit toothless by that setup that they had. What did you make of the way Leicester set up, Graham?
Yeah, to be honest, I have a whole load of contrasting and paradoxical thoughts about this match that I don't really have a solid conclusion over who played well and who played badly, who got it right and who got it wrong. I think Rodgers did some good things. I think Tuchel did some good things, and I also think he did some bad things. And one of the areas that I think Tuchel, I know I'm slightly shifting it a little bit, but I'll come back to Leicester.
This is basically how I was too, Graham. Yeah. So I'm excited to hear you go with it.
Yeah, one of the things I think Tuchel did get wrong was I feel like he was a little bit too reactive to Leicester City. And the proof of that is how he shaped his team, or how the personnel he used on the right side of the pitch. So he had Reece James as the right-sided centre-back, which is obviously where Azpilicueta usually plays, and Azpilicueta is the right wing back, and James was there to keep hold of Vardy, and he did a very good job of that. Vardy, I thought, had a pretty quiet game. I mean, he did have a couple good moments and stretched the pitch from time to time, but that robbed Chelsea of an outlet down the right side. And so I wonder whether keeping hold of Vardy was actually worth Chelsea being poorer as an attacking outlet. And I think Leicester did a really good job of matching up to Chelsea. They obviously had a similar system in the way that they had three at the back. But I also look at their system and think that the success of their team kind of came from individual performances. So obviously Tielemans smacks one in from 30 yards. I thought he was brilliant actually throughout the match, not just in terms of that goal. But, you know, Schmeichel, you mentioned there, comes up with some brilliant saves. That one from Mount in particular, I think, is one of the saves of the season. But again, that's down to kind of individual brilliance. And then Soyuncu, who I thought was really, really good. But again, that just comes from him. And I don't want to minimise things too much for Rodgers, but it just comes from Soyuncu having the determination to stick his head on everything and then get in front of everything. And just having that, once Evans goes off as well, just having that presence of mind to organise things about him. So I honestly don't know. I struggle to work this one out. I don't know if this was the right result or the wrong result. And yeah, I just think it was a really interesting match that could have gone either way. And the one moment of brilliance, the one moment of quality was produced by Leicester, and that's what got them over the line.
Graham, I think that distinction you're making about Reece James as the right center back is more important maybe than, and Ryan, you brought this up originally. I think I was just like, yeah, you know, you play somebody there, you deal with Vardy. But I kind of forgot how effective Reece James was on that right side against Man City in their last Champions League game, and just how he kept being the one to beat somebody and then drive the ball forward 30 yards. And even if it was down the channel, he would get a cross in, or he would cut it back and try to find somebody open. I think that's how they score one of their goals, in fact, or at least recently. I think he's been so critical to them in their attack that to then have him sit back and be a center back, yes, he can still get involved as like a late arriving runner or making a sort of counterattacking run, but then you've left Jamie Vardy open, and that's sort of the entire point of what you're doing. So you're right, that is a bit of a conundrum. I'm not sure why that was the plan there, aside from Jamie Vardy is fast and he's their only option, is maybe what Thomas Tuchel was thinking. But other than that, that is a head-scratcher.
Little bit. Is there any coincidence in the fact that Chelsea maybe were questionable on their right channel? We talk about Azpilicueta and James over there, and Leicester seemed rather good there. Soyuncu being the left-sided centre-back, and Luke Thomas, who was very impressive in this one. I think he got the assist for Tielemans effectively, yeah. Didn't he? And well, he was good against Man United midweek as well, and he seems to be one to watch, I would suggest, Graham.
Yeah, absolutely. And Leicester just have this knack of producing brilliant defenders. Sorry, getting tongue-tied a bit there. You know, because James Justin is another one who's had an excellent season. They've just sold Ben Chilwell last summer for, you know, 50 million. Timothy Castagne on the right side. Ricardo Pereira didn't play in this game. So is there a team outside Man City who have as good and as the sort of depth in the fullback positions and the wing-back positions that Leicester have? I'm struggling to think of another one.
It's impressive. It's definitely impressive. Taylor, I want to talk to you about Kasper Schmeichel as well, because watching this, and this is going to sound incredibly cliche, but I was reminded so much of his dad and his peak Peter Schmeichel sort of performance here. Did you get any of those vibes at all? And I think maybe we don't think of Schmeichel as like a Leicester legend, but he kind of deserves to be.
Yeah.
In many ways.
I think he's definitely getting there. At least for Leicester fans, he probably is. What was it, Ryan? Because I don't disagree with you. I'm just wondering, what was it that reminded you of Peter Schmeichel?
I just remember Schmeichel making lots of those sort of really awesome reflex saves, like he didn't like that shot from Mason Mount that Graham mentioned there. And just because and in clutch moments, exactly. And just because they look very similar and their body, and their movement is quite similar as well. I think that's what stirs it mostly.
But I think it's the movement, absolutely. You're right. That sort of, it's almost like the way This is a very esoteric reference. I apologize to both of you, unless you're both secret hockey fans. But like Dominik Hasek, the old like Buffalo Sabres goalie, would have these weird like rainbow dives that you wouldn't expect from a hockey goalkeeper. And that's kind of what Kasper Schmeichel does, where he, it almost looks like he doesn't need to dive, but he does to then be able to maneuver his hand in such a way that he can push the ball wide or push the ball onto a post. But it's also that wrist strength. That's another thing I think of with Peter Schmeichel, is the ability to save a shot. Maybe your fingers, maybe just the top of your palm, but the wrist stays strong such that the ball is denied or pushed wide again. And we saw that in this game on a couple different occasions, Kasper Schmeichel having the strength, but the footwork, and then the kind of jumping ability to put himself in the right position to make some saves and be that reliable stopper. And I think to bring it home, that is what Peter Schmeichel was for Manchester United, definitely not Manchester City, although I think he had a spell there. But for United, it was that sort of, you know, he's there. Maybe he's going to have an off game here and there, but for the most part, he's the Danish Wall. And I guess his son is the Danish Wall Jr., but it's that same level of reliability and form, I think, that inspires the Leicester defense. So yeah, I think it's a pretty apt comparison and a pretty good game for Kasper Schmeichel as well.
Sorry, Ryan. In a weird way, I think Kasper doesn't get the credit he deserves because his dad is Peter. And I know that's that works the other way to the way it usually works, where like Jordi Cruyff gets a move to Manchester United because he's got Cruyff on the back of his shirt. But with Kasper Schmeichel, the first thought for a lot of people is, oh, well, he's not as good as Peter Schmeichel. And that is true. But Peter Schmeichel's arguably the best goalkeeper of the Premier League era. And Kasper Schmeichel, for me, has been one of the best goalkeepers in the league for a number of years now, and kind of gets overlooked a little bit.
Yeah.
I'll pull you up on that, Graham. I think Jordi Cruyff actually had Jordi on his shirt because he didn't want to be associated with Cruyff, right, as if we all didn't know why he was in that Manchester United team. And boy did that show. I think this was not the most exciting game in general, but as far as FA Cup finals go, Taylor, this was right up there for me, just because of the emotion of the situation, the fact that we had an amazing goal. We had an incredible save. This was 33 years to the week since my team, Wimbledon, had a true underdog moment at this very stadium, beating Liverpool in this same cup final.
There's the Wimbledon reference.
They come every week. You never know when they're going to come, but they do come. And I've actually done the second one because I talked about our kits earlier, but hey, here we are. I'm a broken record. But I just think the FA Cup has lacked a lot of passion and emotions in recent iterations, one could argue. And it just felt like this was the game we needed right now.
Which is a strange thing to say about a game that finishes 1-0 with a disallowed goal controversially. And I think a first half that I have lots of notes. I don't know how much I'm using those notes for this conversation, because it was a pretty even game. I don't think it was necessarily that like 4-3, 3-2 spectacle that we're going to talk about maybe later on with some games from this weekend. But I think for the FA Cup finals we've had in recent memory, and then the ones that we've had, the games we've had recently behind closed doors with no fans there, I think there's absolutely an element of like, oh, right, this matters and people care about it and it's fun and it's always fun to win a cup. And the way it played out in those final minutes was, I think, enough drama to make it a good game overall. So, yeah, I'm with you.
Indeed. Thanks for being with me, Tay-Tay. Well, that's one Chelsea Cup loss on the books there. Let's cover another one in a few minutes.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Total Soccer Show, we are back. We are talking the Women's Champions League final between Chelsea and Barcelona very shortly, right after Graham Ruthven comes in with a Jamie Vardy update.
Yeah. Jamie Vardy will just not stop being Jamie Vardy, even for one moment. There's a story that I'm going around this morning, and I'm afraid it's actually uncredited. It looks a little bit like The Athletic or maybe The Telegraph, but I'm just going to read a very quick section of it about how he celebrated the FA Cup win. So it's: most of the squad went their separate ways afterwards and travelled back to Leicester with their families, with Vardy celebrating on the way home with some Desperados beers in the car with his family. The forward would go to bed with his winner's medal around the neck, just as he did in 2016, and wake for a McDonald's breakfast.
What is happening?
Just to be clear, Desperados beers are tequila-infused beers for all
that's right, yeah. He is single-handedly debunking sports science as an industry.
Does he just run so much? Is he in that good of shape that he's one of those where it just doesn't matter because he burns it all off? That's the only thing I can figure, because that made me feel sluggish and ill just hearing those things that he went for. Also, what are the open container laws in England? That's actually what Boris Johnson has proposed they'd be rewritten as, I think.
Yeah, nobody checks. Yeah. The thing about Jamie Vardy is, if you told me this was his pre-match routine, I would have believed that as well.
Taylor, if you want to know about the container laws in the UK, go to Scotland and look at what 9 out of 10 people on the street are doing, and you'll find out.
I think there's just a difference. Yeah, walking, I get, and I'm envious of. In the car, I guess I'm assuming he wasn't driving, so I think that's how Virginia is. As long as you're not driving, it's fine, which is an approach to safe alcohol consumption. But yeah, Jamie Vardy maybe just won't be my model of how to prepare for games as an athlete. That said, Ryan, it also feels like something that your local amateur team would have done before shooting those shots on the goal before your warm-ups began.
Most likely. All I know is that I'd have Vardy over Werner. Anyway, why don't we move on to the Champions League final, the Women's Champions League final, which took place this weekend, to Chelsea not having a fun time of this one. 4-0 to Barcelona, this one finished. Chelsea conceding an own goal after 35 seconds, which kind of set the tone for this one. Taylor, this was an interesting one because we came into this one knowing that Emma Hayes' Chelsea a very impressive team. Not sure that was reflected in this performance because was it because of Chelsea's shortcomings here or the fact that Barcelona were absolutely phenomenal? It felt like, we say it about Man City playing a different at a different speed and playing a different game sometimes. Watching this one, it really felt like Barcelona were kind of on a different planet. And we know about this team coming into this game, like undefeated in the league, 26 wins and no draws, with 129 goals scored and 5 conceded coming into this one. They're 6 games shy of being undefeated and they're on for a treble, blah, blah, blah. They're a very, very amazing team. They're technically astute and tactically very good. What was I guess I'm asking, was it a poor Chelsea performance or just they were completely outclassed?
I'm going to say it was an unstoppable force meeting a fairly movable object. and even when that object didn't move, it then gave the unstoppable force another opportunity to have a go. Because I think it definitely was not Chelsea looking particularly strong. And you could say it was the slow start, the fact that they go down, what, inside 35 seconds. But at the same time, that the way they concede that goal is very reminiscent of the way they played most of that first half, which was slow on the ball, not quite sure what they wanted to do with it. With Barcelona, there were triangles, there were wall passes, there were really good combinations through the middle, out wide. It seemed like there were lots of sort of third runs when attackers knowing exactly where they needed to be as the other attacker was like vacating space, another was moving into it. And there were so many patterns and rotations for Barcelona that it there stood out even more when you look at Chelsea and how there was just delay on the ball. There was waiting. There was an extra touch. There was an extra two touches. And for at least two, maybe all of the goals, it's Chelsea maybe should have made a stronger play, could have made a stronger play, but failing to do so and being made to pay for it. And yeah, 4-0 down inside the first 35 minutes for the first goal in the first 35 seconds is something.
It was quite something, yeah. And I'm just trying to think of who I thought were good performances from Chelsea. Like Sam Kerr and Harder up top and maybe Frank Kirby were pretty decent. But everywhere else on the field, you could see so many shortcomings. And Graham, this was supposed to be a pretty defensively solid team. But you look at the centre-back pairing here. They seem way off in this game. The full-backs, they couldn't match Barcelona on the flanks at all here. And G and Leupolz in midfield on the wide positions, they seem to have very poor games. Even Ann-Kathrin Berger, the goalkeeper, just seemed to be making terrible decisions, several of which were costly in this game. Were they just a bit asleep for this one in some ways, Graham?
They just never recovered from that first 10 minutes, did they? I mean, it really was. I mean, it was a panicked performance in those first 10 minutes. Everything from Berger looking very nervous and distributing poor out from the back and flappy hands a few times. And obviously, I think one of the things we should mention is it was a bit of a makeshift Chelsea defence. So, you know, Carter at right back is you know, an attack minded winger, naturally. You know, she's number seven. And Charles on the left side is, you know, a right footer playing at left back. And I think that really showed. And I had to kind of fight that urge to really go hard on Chelsea because, I mean, Mertens on that side on the left wing for Barcelona just had one of the best performances I've seen from an individual in soccer this season, and just it just felt like every time she ran at Carter that something was happening, and I think for the third goal where it's Mertens who kind of drives to the byline, and then I can't remember who it is that she scores for. Is that the Bonmati goal?
But Bonmati, anyway,
yeah, the third goal and the defending from Carter is just, it's so poor. Just to kind of, she almost like kind of leans into her and doesn't make any sort of tackle. It's just, or I think that might have been actually the fourth goal. That was Graham Hansen's goal, wasn't it? But the defending for the third goal, which is the tackle, is so weak as well. It was a poor performance from Chelsea, but one of the things they should take encouragement from is Barcelona not so long ago were in a similar sort of situation. They lost 4-0 they were 4-0 down at halftime in a Champions League final against Lyon, and they've kind of built back up. And I do feel like with Emma Hayes in charge and with Chelsea making signings like Sam Kerr, and there is a determination to get better. And I think that was very much the vibe from Hayes after the match was, this was a poor performance. This was, you know, we weren't good enough, but we'll be back and we'll improve on that. And I do think there is a determination at Chelsea that there isn't at other English big clubs.
Hopefully, yeah, as you say, Graham, Chelsea treat this as a galvanising moment because that's the most positive way they can do it. But yeah, certainly a disappointing outing for them. But Taylor, as we mentioned there, Barcelona were just very, very impressive. This is a kind of an academy-built team in many ways, if you will. A lot of, you know, they seem to be mostly Spanish and built on kind of a Barca philosophy. They came out swinging here. They were pretty quick to steal the ball from the outset, quite evidently, as I think Chelsea hadn't even touched the ball by the time that first own goal had gone in, apart from the own goal touch, obviously. They were pressing pretty high, and I think, as Graham said, it was Lika Martins who stood out for me, who I felt was Kevin De Bruyne-esque in the control of the game, and seemed to be involved in all four goals, Taylor, and just a very impressive player for me. And Bonmati was very, very impressive too, but it was Martins that stood out for me.
I would say that maybe Lika Martins is faster than Kevin De Bruyne based on this performance in this game, because yes, she embarrassed some defenders with the pace, but then I think the pace then became a setup to use the technical ability to get around people, to pull in more defenders, and it was, she was far and away, every time there was a player on the ball who was just dusting a Chelsea defender, but then also cutting back to meg them, it was sort of like, oh, okay, I can just assume that's Lika Martins doing that. And then anytime there was a player like stretching the line and making smart runs in behind, I could assume that that was Hermoso, who I believe got a goal in there. Yes. I haven't checked him. Thank you. But yeah, overall, I'm with you that I think Chelsea could use this as motivation to continue to build and get some things right next time. I think the addition of Reitan made a big difference in the second half, although obviously it doesn't change anything. But for Barcelona, yeah, I think this is a team that they can just continue to build as a cohesive unit and continue to be as dominant as they've been until somebody can catch them. I'm assuming Lyon will try to find a way to make that happen next year in the Champions League. But I thought this was a really fun game, which is not necessarily surprising given that you have four goals, but also sometimes when you have a blowout like this, it's not that captivating of a game. But because of how dominant Barcelona were and the way that they went about getting the goals and just kind of causing Chelsea nightmares across the board, Leopold's out at halftime, I think. I felt very bad for her for having to spend the second half just thinking about all the different things that went wrong for her in the first half.
Yeah, that was quite harsh getting pulled at halftime. And I think it was, Graham referenced it, I think it was Neem Charles. Was it the fourth goal where she was wildly out of position and didn't
beaten four
really
times. Yeah.
Try and challenge for the ball at all? And it just didn't seem like their night, unfortunately.
She legitimately got beaten three times in that sequence. Yeah. She gets outrun for the initial ball in, then she catches up and gets beaten again. Like, and then as Lika Martins is getting to the end line, she beats her one more time. So three moments of Lika Martins embarrassing one defender in about a 10-second period.
I know this Barcelona team are... I mean, the season they've had has been utterly incredible. 26, won 26 out of 26 in the Spanish league, 28 goals, conceded just five. So it's possibly the case that they are just an unbelievable team. But I do feel like Chelsea are better than they showed in this performance. And I do wonder just how much of this was down to stage fright, I think, as Emma Hayes called it, especially just at least the 4-0 scoreline. And I thought it was quite telling that Chelsea, the one player that they had who I thought seemed to have some form of composure and just seemed to be quite comfortable on the stage, and even so she missed a few chances, was Harder. And obviously she's been here before last year, you know, with Wolfsburg. So yeah, I do wonder just if this was a case of, as I say, stage fright and just Chelsea getting a shock of the level of Barcelona. And now they've had that shock, whether they would actually get that shock a second time. I feel like they would, and if they face Barcelona again, I don't think they would, the gulf would be quite so massive.
There was such a confidence in the way Barcelona attacked in contrast to what Chelsea were trying to do that you could see, because I honestly didn't think Harder even had that good of a game. She obviously gets into good attacking positions, but then doesn't take those chances. Yeah. And I'm not saying you said she was having like
She did miss chances. I just felt like she was the one who didn't look like her mind was scrambled. Yeah.
I would agree with that. I would say though that like with some of those chances she misses, you can see that like, I hope I score this sort of idea as she's striking the ball. And with Barcelona, I think in contrast, you just saw the, I am going to score this mentality. And that's just such a difference. If you're shooting and not really, I've talked about this before, if you're shooting and not really thinking about it, but just knowing what you want to do and then doing the mechanics properly, you're so much more likely to score than, I hope I get this right, I hope I finish this right. And you like, maybe you like turtle headed a little bit when you go to head the ball because you're not quite sure you're backing yourself.
And you do what?
You know, when you like, crouch your head down. So instead of going to meet the ball with your head, I'm doing it right now.
I know what you mean.
Telling my voice. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, that means something different where I come from.
Yeah,
okay.
Me too, but I get what you mean, Taylor.
I mean, maybe they had to poo as well. It could have been that.
Goodness me. Well, I, for one, welcome our Barcelona Feminil overlords.
Also, can we just make the point, Barcelona, like, maybe look at that team and see what happens when you have a bunch of homegrown players come through and then you bring in a couple like next level players to like round out that squad. Maybe just a reminder for the Barcelona men's side that bring through your academy players and rely on them and you see what happens.
That seems to have worked before for them.
Yeah,
so maybe they should take note from the women's side. Definitely. Well, speaking of Barcelona's men's side, we're going to be talking about them, the Spanish title race, and a bit of Calcio as well after these messages.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Total Soccer Show, we have returned, everybody, and we are talking Calcio, Derby d'Italia specifically, or the Conte Derby, as we may call it, Juventus against Internazionale, this one finishing 3-2 to Juventus, a pretty eventful one, a huge game for Juve as well. They're now 1 point off the top four with one game to go after Milan drew with Cagliari at the weekend. That race for Champions League soccer getting very, very tight. Next week, by the way, Milan are at Atalanta and Juve are at Bologna. It's very delicately poised. We have Juve, Milan and Napoli all fighting for two Champions League spots, with Atalanta, by the way, securing their place in the Champions League. But Graham, this one was a wild, wild derby d'Italia. Quite a lot going on. We had quite a lot of penalties. We had quite a lot of red cards, at least two red cards, I should say. Do you remember, Graham, how Juventus got relegated for choosing favourable referees? I'm just mentioning it out of no reason whatsoever, really. But anyway, what are your thoughts on the game?
Oh man, this match was chaotic. This Derby Italia woke up and chose violence, is how I would put it. Two red cards, three penalties, a saved penalty, which obviously Ronaldo scores at the rebound, two fight backs, five goals. It was everything I really wanted from this match. And you're right, some questionable decisions from the referee. I mean, I don't know whether the UK broadcast didn't show many replays of the Cuadrado penalty kick in particular. Mm. I didn't get a good angle on that, despite the fact I deliberately went looking for one. I don't know about you guys, but that one seemed soft in particular.
Yeah. We didn't. I'm with you. We didn't get a lot of replays of different moments, and those that we did, I think, were still confusing. I think it is part of the problem of when you have. I'm assuming this game was called from a monitor, and so the people who are doing it have to kind of rely on what's in front of them, and they can't see the other stuff that's going on as you can in person. But I felt like some of the red cards as well, at least the first one, the Brozovic one, a little bit more straightforward. But
yeah,
forgive me, I have it in my notes who was sent off. Bentancur. I think like. It didn't even make sense to me why that happened. And then I'm with you, Graham, for the penalty that it just seems like Perisic is tracking. It's the Cruyff turn from Cuadrado. And then the question is, does the like physics of the Cruyff turn require him to kind of put the left leg out the way he does so he can cut back behind it? Or is he doing that to deliberately make contact and then fall over? Because if you watch it one way, it looks exactly like, oh yeah, it's just the physics of the Cruyff turn. And then if you watch it thinking, is he trying to get contact? You will absolutely see him trying to get contact. And I think you're right that maybe a few more replays or a little bit more analysis would have been helpful, but I'm still confused right now.
It was quite a game for Cuadrado. He scored the goal for 2-1, which was a galazzo, basically, and a decent shot from long distance. And he's involved again with that penalty to make it 3-2, as you say, with a questionable amount of contact to win it. But some top-class poophousery, I'd say, from Cuadrado, either way. And also, obviously, he's the one who gets tackled when Brozovic gets his second yellow card as well, when he's attempting a breakaway. So, well, I guess, Graham, Cuadrado, is he underrated? Is he adequately rated? We don't seem to talk much about him when we talk about Juventus.
Yeah, I think there's a case that he's slightly underrated, although I was reading about him that he is a bit of a favourite of the Juventus fans, so I think that might be quite an Anglo-centric opinion. Obviously, a lot of Premier League fans remember him from when he wasn't so good for Chelsea, but he's probably been... I was thinking about this earlier. He's probably been Juventus's most consistent player over the course of this season. Now, there hasn't been much competition for that, and obviously you'd maybe point to Ronaldo, who I think scored his 29th goal of the season in this game, but his performances are a little bit strange, and his numbers don't quite align with how he's played this season. So yeah, I think Cuadrado is one of the few players at Juventus this season who comes out of it with any sort of credit.
And then for me, when I think of Cuadrado, I think the first team I think of is Colombia. And I think it's the same thing there where you have James Rodriguez, who's always going to be the name, and Radamel Falcao a few years ago as well, have the big names. They're going to get the media attention. But when those two are injured, it tends to be Juan Cuadrado who has to carry that team and make things happen. And even when they're there, he's such an important part of that team that I think he's accurately rated as being an important player, but he's never going to be, or at least hasn't been, that sort of the player that leads that team that you're going to kind of put on the highlight reel package of Colombia versus Brazil, Juan Cuadrado versus Neymar. It's never going to be that level of billing, and I think that extends to Juventus as well, but you see what he offers and the versatility he brings of being able to play on either side as a defender or as an attacker and draw a penalty and score a penalty and score a clutch penalty at that.
It was some curious moments from Andrea Pirlo in this game, I thought, as well. Ronaldo coming off of Morata. Chiesa getting a move. Was it Demiral, I think, who came on for him? Yeah. And McKennie actually came on and, I thought, made things a little bit more stable in midfield as well, to be fair there. The one I wanted to talk about, though, Taylor, is Ronaldo, who I was listened with intent to your conversation with Christine Kupo on the podcast last weekend, which was excellent. I recommend anyone goes back to check that out if they haven't heard it already. And to build on that conversation about Ronaldo, I just noticed that he seems more than ever quite detached from this team.
Yep.
He definitely wasn't celebrating the other goals that he did not score. He seemed a bit like he got away with the penalty with the rebound and everything. It's like he's a separate unit to the rest of this team, isn't he? And it feels like he's in his he's in a glass case of unemotion.
Yeah, and it's also that extends to his positioning on the field, because I would say Juve, though I think they're listed as a 4-4-2, I think a lot of the times it was a 4-1-4-1 or it was a 4-4-1-1 with Kulusevski dropping in centrally, and that meant it was supposed to be Ronaldo leading the line, but I saw him drifting to left center, I saw him drifting out wide, and maybe that is part of the game, part of what they're supposed to be doing. It could be trying to create overloads, but I also saw him going and standing on two different occasions. It was Rabio, and I don't love Rabio that much, but I don't think this is him this time, that Ronaldo would go stand next to him, maybe 5 yards away, and Rabiot would look over his shoulder and see Ronaldo, and there'd be a half second of what? Okay. And then he would go a different direction to try to find space. And it did seem to me, I saw those moments as being not Ronaldo being that dominant force. He goes where he wants, he does what he wants, and everybody adjusts around him like we've seen in the past. It felt more like he still is kind of doing that, but you don't have that swagger, or at least as much swagger. You don't have the ability, the consistent ability at that to back that up. And so you're right that he seemed like a guy who was sort of drifting around trying to find space. Yes, he scores a penalty or scores the rebound off the penalty, but fundamentally it's not that dominant performance that justifies that sort of we'll all move to make sure that you're happy, to make sure that you can do what you want to do, that sometimes still seems to linger when it comes to Ronaldo playing for Juve.
Graham Ruthven, prediction time. Where does Ronaldo go next season? I think you mentioned before we came on air that there's rumours that he's been shipping his supercars somewhere or other, which is the classic millionaire sign that you're on the move.
Yeah, Twitter's got video of all his supercars being loaded into a massive truck at his Turin home. So that's a clear sign that he's off. I mean, I do wonder where they're being shipped to. Where are those cars going? Does Ronaldo own a private island in the shape of his head somewhere in the...
I know that you're saying that in jest, but the answer is yes. And then I think he gifted it to his agent. He bought his agent an island.
I actually think you got it wrong. He's actually a big fan of the TV show from the 80s, Knight Rider, which famously the car would ride back into the back of a truck. So he wants to do that move while on the highway. Just drive his car into a truck.
I like that you say that's the famous part of Knight Rider, as though it wasn't the fact that it was a talking car.
The car talked?
Yeah, man. I think with Mr. Feeney's voice.
It did have Mr.
World.
Feeney's voice. The teacher who followed Corey Matthews from nursery all the way through to college, which isn't weird at all.
So what you're saying is that Ronaldo has a fleet of Knight Rider cars. Those are his friends, and now they've decided that they're going off somewhere else because he's had enough at Juventus.
I'm so sad.
Is Jorge Mendes programmed his voice into one of those cars?
He's like,
I like to think that Weston McKennie got programmed into one of them. They seem like they're buddies.
Hey, yeah. Weston, take me to Lisbon. I'm sorry, Cristiano. I can't let you do that.
Oh, no, we've made it Dave now. Oh, no. Now we're in trouble. Or no, I'm sorry, Dave, whatever that thing is called. Yeah, I don't like that at all. I don't like that at all.
Oh, wonderful tangent. We don't know where Ronaldo's going to be. It seems unlikely he'll be in Juventus given their precarious situation. We've spent a relatively long time on Italy. We have lots to get to on this podcast, gents. Why don't we turn our attention to Spain and the title race, which is still as electric as ever. It's going down to the final day, Graham. We've got the two Madrid teams who will be facing each other for the right to win the title. Atleti in the driving seat at the moment after this weekend's results, which went as follows. Athletic Club were beaten 1-0 by Real Madrid. Atleti getting a clutch win over Osasuna, 2-1 in that one. Villarreal and Sevilla were virtually out of the picture, but they got a 4-0 pounding from Villarreal as well. And Barcelona, who will finish outside the top two for the first time since 2007-08, falling 2-1 to Celta Vigo. Graham, I suppose the game we should start with is Atleti and Luis Suarez saving the day.
Yeah, certainly did. And also Moussa Dembele, who put in the group chat, jumped so high over... You know how you see someone hopping over a shot a little bit? Moussa Dembele is, you know that way where you jump where your knees are up to your chin?
Mm-hmm.
He's jumping so high because he knows if he blocks that shot, he's never playing another game for Atletico Madrid. But yes, very, very typical of this season that I guess that Suarez would come up with the big moment for Atleti. What I would say about this day in La Liga was it was quite overwhelming with all the games being played mm-hmm. at once. So I'm not sure you're going to get much sort of tactical analysis out of me today, just because, as I say, it was overwhelming and having to keep an eye on so many games. And I didn't actually watch all that much live of the Barcelona Celta Vigo game, because obviously they are kind of, they needed a miracle to still be in it. So I was watching Real Madrid and Atletico Madrid, but I thought the two performances of Atleti and Real Madrid were typical of their season, in that Real Madrid did just enough to beat Athletic Club. I don't think they were particularly impressive. And then Atleti going through the ringer, all the emotions, falling behind with 10 minutes to go, going through it all and then finding a way to beat Osasuna. I think I said a week ago or 2 weeks ago that actually Atleti being in this sort of grind might be their comfort zone. And I actually think that, I mean, ignore the fact I said Barcelona were going to win La Liga title at the same time. But I think that's kind of been proven right. This kind of feels like Atleti are going to get it done in the way that Atleti know how.
Well, I agree, Graham, because this, sorry, Ryan, I just wanted to add that, like, I think this season, for like how much we've talked about, like, the impact of COVID and not really getting that much of a break between last season and the start of this one, and injuries and having to deal with fatigue, like, you don't have Madrid looking their peak. You certainly don't have Barcelona looking their peak. You do have Atletico, like, making difficult circumstances work, which is what I tend to think of them doing really, really well, especially under Diego Simeone. So I think you're also right to kind of throw tactics out a little bit at this point, because you have so many injuries and so many different question marks around so many different teams that it just becomes like, just find a way to win, guys. And in this case, Suarez, Carrasco, Correa tried to find a win about 14,000 times before they eventually did, but they do, and that's what's important.
Yeah, and it was a well-scripted game, this one, with the couple of offside goals before, Atleti didn't even take the lead in this game until, the 88th minute, and they had 73% possessions. They had 26 shots to Osasuna's 5. It feels it's a bit damning when you look at it from that perspective, but yeah, a very dramatic game. Atleti now must beat Valladolid next week to ensure they win La Liga ahead of Real Madrid. Valladolid's owner, by the way, Brazilian Ronaldo, which is an interesting link to Madrid there. Madrid are 2 points behind. They've got Villarreal next weekend. Villarreal, who I mentioned, beat Sevilla 4-0 this weekend. So I imagine that will be no easy task for them. So it is fairly delicately poised. Graham, it feels a bit like the ending when Atleti last won the league, was it? And they had like a 0-0 they crunched out with Barca on the final day. And that kind of, as you say, sort of hanging on for dear life to win.
Yeah, a famous 1-1 at the Camp Nou on the last day of the season. I think 2013-14 season, Diego Godin with the kind of famous goal. And yeah, that very, very much feels like, to be honest, I had that sense from the 0-0 draw at the Camp Nou. I can't remember, was that 1 or 2 weeks ago? Whenever that was, felt quite reminiscent of that. And I feel like Atleti have been liberated by getting through that match against Barcelona where they have it in their own hands, and they just need to win the matches they've got. And after all this talk of Atleti modernising and become a slightly different team under Simeone, and they have to a certain extent, like they do, they are better in the ball. Some players like Carrasco, what a season he has had. I mean, when he returned to Atleti from China, I think everyone was really, really surprised because he wasn't that good in his first stint at Atletico Madrid. And now he's arguably been their player of the season along with Suarez. And I don't think he thrives in a previous Atleti team. So they have changed a little bit, but yet they've still come to the business end of a season and they are doing it in the way only Atletico Madrid can and know how to do it. So there's a little bit of comfort in that. And I think they're going to do it now. Like, they're going to beat Valladolid in the last day of the season. And if they don't, all those Atleti fans who are outside the Wanda at the weekend, I'll, I'll post my home address and you can come and abuse me.
Oh, wow.
I do like, though, Graham, that you're absolutely right that there was this going to be this expansive, free-flowing Atleti team that is not what I would say they are now. But you do have João Félix coming on and getting a very nice assist with a good ball over the top for the equalizer. And then I thought also Kieran Trippier, who is maybe splitting the difference between the two, though I think of as more a like Simeone-style 4-4-2 defender. But his set-piece delivery, some of the crosses he puts into the first half, and then I think the same in the second half, I thought he was also a really important and excellent player for them on the day. But I think, in the end, I'm giving all the credit to Carrasco because he just kind of doesn't stop, ever. He just keeps running and moving and finding space and standing people up and doing stepovers and then getting assists for game winners. Well done, Carrasco. Well done, Atleti.
Well done, and begrudgingly well done, Luis Suarez, who is on the cusp of winning Liga titles with two different teams. And Barca fans can say what they want about Josep Bartomeu, but he did have the foresight to sell him to Atleti to stop Madrid winning a title. So, That's impressive stuff. And talking about Real Madrid's game with Athletic, I think Graham touched on it. Not the best of games by all accounts, and Real Madrid grinding out a 1-0 win at a very difficult place to go, San Mamés. Of course, the Basque Country is not an easy trip for any team. But so credit to Real Madrid for coming out with 3 points there. But Barcelona, a good day for their women's side, not so much for their men's side, suffering at Celta Vigo here. Their defence letting them down once again in this one, and Ter Stegen having another poor game as well. Leo Messi looking a bit wasteful, Graham, in this one as well. What do we make of the Barcelona roller coaster of a season they've had? Once again, I feel like 1 week I'm saying they're terrible, the next week they're superb. I don't know where this roller coaster is going to settle.
It's been a funny season for Barcelona. At some points, they've been brilliant. And I felt like before that Granada game where they lost at home, I honestly felt I was pretty confident Barcelona were going to win the Liga. And yet they throw away that game, poor against Atletico Madrid and at the Camp Nou, and then a poor performance and result here. They faltered down the stretch, and it's not a good quality for a Barcelona team to have. And it now seems like Koeman might actually pay with his job. There's reports in Spain and in Catalonia that he's not going to start next season as Barcelona manager. I saw a Mediaset journalist reporting that Xavi is returning to Barcelona this week and that he counted 22 suitcases with him on the way to the airport, which I don't know. That doesn't say to me that he's going back to Barcelona on vacation.
Do we just have luggage spotters? Is that what we have now? Do we just have shipment spotters around Europe for moves that are happening? We got cars moving, 22 suitcases coming in.
Yeah, I just hope one of those suitcases has a new centre forward in it for Barcelona.
Andres Iniesta is crammed in there somewhere, I think. I think, was it last week, Ryan, that you asked, like, do we think Ronald Koeman will be there next season?
Possibly.
If it was, it was either last weekend or the weekend before. But either way, it shows how quickly things change. That I remember seeing that question and being like, yeah, no, he's going to be there. Like, I think he's done enough. He's changed the shape. He's gotten some things figured out. And then you start to see, like, almost as soon as we hit publish, and probably before, and I just didn't see it. But you start to see those, like, oh, there's some questions as to what he's done here, or why isn't Ricky Puig playing? That seems to have come back. And there needs to be more academy development. And there's just those little leaks that we know from Barcelona are sometimes intentional and seem to be laying the groundwork for, you know what, it's a bunch of little things that aren't working, so let's make the big decision. And it does seem like now that's where they're heading. And we may well have a summer where we don't have a manager at Barcelona, and we don't have a manager at Real Madrid. So I guess Atletico Madrid, the pillar of stability in La Liga these days.
Maybe those managers should switch places.
Let's do that. Let's see how well that goes over.
Change places! That would be fun, wouldn't it? I like that.
Oh boy, we'll get some pig heads thrown for sure.
Indeed. Pig heads aplenty at the Camp Nou. The Spanish title race, as we say, will go down to the final day, and it is in Atleti's hands to get the title once again. That just about wraps up the games we were going to cover, gents. Let's move into injury time. I'd like to turn our attention to the Turkish Superliga, and Taylor, as our former Turkish resident on the podcast, would you like to take the lead on explaining the tightness of the league and what happened there?
Sure. You had Fenerbahce with a late potential challenge at the end of the season, but they were not involved in the eventual title race. What you did have was Besiktas winning the Turkish Super League with 84 points, Galatasaray in a distant second also with 84 points. And then the big thing there would be the goal difference, Besiktas winning their game against Göztepe 2-1, giving them a plus 45 goal difference, Galatasaray winning against Malatyaspor 3-1, which gave them plus 44. So Besiktas are your Turkish champions by one goal, literally.
One single goal on goal difference. Yeah, that's pretty tight, I would say.
And I don't want to throw around accusations, but Besiktas won a game at the start of this month 7-0. I'm just going to leave it there. Not saying
it tends to be Fenerbahce who get those accusations, but you never know. You never know. But I think it was a strange season. I think Fenerbahce spending a lot of money, but not really having a plan. Galatasaray not spending as much money and kind of having a plan. I guess it ends up being Besiktas who win it in comfortable style with that one goal at the very end. But it does mean we have Gyandre Yedlin for Galatasaray in the Champions League next season. And I think that's what we're all mostly concerned about.
Yeah. Besiktas getting a nice pat on the back, I noticed on social media from Erdogan as well, which was... warms the heart. Yeah.
It's funny because they do not like him. Like, at all. So, does it,
and Erdogan has links to Besiktas here, doesn't he? Is that not a thing?
I believe the stadium is named after him.
Right. So there you go. Yes. Yeah. So yes. Yeah.
Isn't that wonderful? Elsewhere in injury time, Graham, let's turn our attentions to Scotland and Rangers sealing their first unbeaten season since 1899. Just the 102 points for Rangers.
Yep, that's still less than Brendan Rodgers Celtic got two or three seasons ago. They got 106, so still got a bit of improvement to the Stevie G. You can improve things a little bit there, but yes, they've just been totally untouchable this season. 26 clean sheets from 38 games, which I think Jose Mourinho would be proud of that. So yes, worth mentioning, quite an achievement for them. The other thing I was going to mention was, I know we referenced it at the start of the show, but is Alisson Becker, the Liverpool goalkeeper, the first player in tracksuit bottoms to score a Premier League goal? I feel like he must be, because Gabba Karai, I don't ever remember him doing that from a corner kick. Oof.
Did Begovic wear trousers?
Did he ever score?
I think he did, didn't he? Way back.
I'm obsessed with this now. I also want to know if anybody's ever scored a goal with a hat on. I miss those days with goalkeepers rocking the hats. We had one of those earlier in the season, and it was my favorite thing about that game.
Who was the Crystal Palace keeper who was used to wear those tatty grey ones?
Yeah,
that's
Gabba Karai. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. That's what you're saying. Yeah. That's a good
question. I think what we need at Rangers is Cristiano Ronaldo. Clearly, that's what they need to put them over the top next season. They weren't over the top enough already. Let's get that going.
Yeah, either they'll get 107 points or they won't even qualify for the Champions League. Could go either way with Cristiano Ronaldo these days.
Oh, imagine those supercars on their way to Scotland. Exciting times, exciting times. And I think Steven Gerrard to Real Madrid is also confirmed now, right, Graham?
Well, it has to happen at some point in his career.
Yeah. One would imagine.
Speaking of exciting times, my final thing I wanted to mention, we have the situation in the Premier League is that we have Leicester, Chelsea, and Liverpool all vying for those final two Champions League spots. We have a title race in France, which will go down to the final day between Lille and PSG. We have the title race in Spain, we've already mentioned. But in the Bundesliga, we know our Champions League teams, we know who will win. I am saying the Bundesliga is the most boring league at this point. It's the problematic league. We got to figure out a way to solve the Bundesliga. For people who are new to the show, I promise I don't actually mean
that. What they should do is, you know how you were talking about Barcelona and Real Madrid swapping managers? What they should do is they should get the second team in the Bundesliga to swap managers with the first. Oh, wait, no, they're already doing that. Really, yeah.
Such a weird managerial merry-go-round in Germany right now. But my question for you all, I wrote this down before we started recording. If you could only choose, if one of these things, if three of them were going to happen and one of them weren't, which one would you choose? Leicester making the Champions League, PSG losing the title, Atleti winning in La Liga, or I think those are my three. So I guess I said four.
And are these,
but I've got three options.
These things we would like to happen or things we think will happen?
Which one would you most like to happen? Which one do you not care as much if it happens? Leicester making the Champions League at the expense of Chelsea or Liverpool, PSG losing the title and Lille therefore winning, or Atleti winning La Liga?
PSG not winning the title, I think, is the
one you least care about.
No, that's the one I would like to see happen.
Okay.
I think Atleti are, like, as much as I would like them to win La Liga, they they're like, they've been up there for a while now. Leicester is probably second at list because, again, I would like to see that happen, but they're pretty consistent. Whereas Lille winning Ligue 1 is something I didn't think would happen at the start of the season. So,
I'm with Graham on that one, I think. Although your OnlyFans followers, looking at your PSG shirt collection, might be dismayed by that decision. But I think it's a close second with me with the Leicester situation, because I'd like to see them get in, and I don't want to see Liverpool sneak it, frankly.
Controversial. There we
are. All right. I've asked, I've answered. Liverpool fans, it's Ryan J. Bailey on Twitter.
Come at me, bros.
Can I just one more mention of
can we just name this segment that and then we're good to go.
Yeah, one thing I would like to recognize is as a bit of a Spanish football fan and through my job cover a lot of Spanish football, really really sad to see Eibar go down at the weekend. They have been brilliant value in La Liga for the last few years, the smallest club in any of the big five leagues in Europe. The Eperu is such a great venue. I've not visited, but I'd really like to go. So I think they will be missed in the Liga, and I hope to see them back pretty soon. Hopefully next season or the season after.
Oh, hopefully so. I've got a soft spot for the Basque teams as well, so that's a sad one as well. That just about concludes the weekend review. Thank you very much, listener, for holding on until this point, if indeed you have. Taylor Rockwell, a privilege to record with you once again.
Right back at you, buddy, and I believe I have to stick around to give you my emotional post-match comments. Is that what we landed on at the beginning of this show?
That's right. Please stay on the line. Meanwhile, Graham Ruthven, onlyfans.com/sexyg, if you want to find him there. And for the meantime, thank you very much, Graham.
Thanks, guys. I'm hopeful that you were able to hear me over the building site noise in the background. Taylor, please edit that out where you can.
I mean, it's a novel choice to live on a construction site. I don't know how that's working for you so far, but I think your kids are getting some nice real-world experience.
Yeah, we deliberately, that was one of the filters we chose was when we were searching for this property, was building site, tick. Give us only building sites.
Beep, beep, the Graham is reversing. Bye, everybody!